Well, hi everyone, and welcome back to CBI at 10. I'm Liz Mosey, I'm an editor at Tortoise, here with you again for a conversation I'm very much looking forward to about yesterday's Queen's speech and last week's local election results. I've actually spent the weekend in Italy, so I'm as much looking forward to finding out what happened as I am to analysing it. So I'm very grateful for our esteemed panellists here with us today who are going to help us navigate what it means, particularly, of course, for business with the CBI. Lovely to meet Simon Colissi Aldridge, who is the relatively new Chief Campaigns Director at the CBI. Relatively new, how new?
Simon? I think we're still counting in weeks. I think I'm on about 10 weeks.
Okay, so yeah, still, yeah, you found out where the printer is, but you haven't yet remembered your password.
Quite how to use it, yeah. 100%.
So, Simon, just to sort of get us going today, tell us a bit about what your role, did your role exist before or is it a new role for you and what you're going to be doing for CBI, just so we know who you are?
Yeah, so my role existed in a way. So Josh Hardy was Deputy Director General and Chief Campaign Director. There is no longer a Deputy Director General. And we've kind of moved campaigns and policy separately, and we also kind of moved in marketing. But that's the machinations of the CBI. Actually, what campaigns is about, it's how we engage with our stakeholders and our different audiences, right? And how we communicate on the work that we're doing for members. So it's about taking what we're hearing from members and turning that into effective and impactful engagement that delivers on member priorities. And I think one of the most interesting parts of my role is balancing that priority, those priorities, balancing our engagement with government, where to push, where to partner, where to go public, where to go private, all thinking about what it is as a whole that we're delivering for business.
Oh, fascinating job and an important one too. So before we get into the main discussion, we're going to talk about 38 bills in the Queen's speech. We're going to talk about local election results with Alice and Greg. But before that, so if we wind back to sort of, you know, up to Wednesday of last week before we all went to the polling station, what's the political and sort of economic backdrop, particularly for these two sort of key moments in the life of this parliament?
It's a really, I would call it a tricky time. Trying not to overuse the word tricky, but it's a good description. So the UK economically is facing stagflation. There's further pressure coming later in the year with energy prices. Inflation is set to rise, the biggest squeeze on consumer spending in a long time. There's a lot of headwinds. Business are coming at this from on the back of COVID and now Ukraine and supply chain disruption. And soaring energy prices are affecting business too. So this is why at the CBI we're always pushing on growth. Mm-hmm. Going for growth, right? Our view is that the way to build a resilient economy that's going to withstand long-term shocks is a relentless focus on productivity. You know, growing business is the way that you can kind of solve this going forward. So that's the economy. And turning to politics, it's also a tricky time. I think it's important to look at this through a consumer lens. So people are kind of feeling the squeeze on the pounds in their pocket in a way that hasn't happened for a really long time. Business is also facing that squeeze in their pocket. Input costs are going massively up in a way that prices for consumers aren't rising as high. There's no more money. That is what the government keep telling us. There is no more money. The Treasury see it as their responsibility to safeguard the economy for future generations. That is the role of the Treasury, right? To take that kind of longer term view on how do you make sure that the economy that you leave behind for future generations is in as good a place as it can be. But that's quite complicated and tricky because the PM likes to spend money. He likes to do things that are, you know, he's got an ambitious levelling up agenda that's going to cost money. He's been saving business through furlough, well, the Chancellor did furlough, but, you know, saving people through lots of different expensive things. The Chancellor can't afford to fund those ambitions. There are three ways that you can pay for things. You can borrow more money. They've already borrowed loads of money. Yeah. You can raise taxes. Taxes have already gone up. So none of these work for the Chancellor. And this, you know, there's been a lot of COVID borrowing and spending. So that's the kind of Chancellor's brain. You've then got Partygate and now Beergate. And that's all kind of simmering and bubbling along in the background. The PM's worrying about the Sue Gray report. He might be worrying slightly less now that the leader of the opposition has said that he will resign if he's fined. But again, if the leader of the opposition does end up resigning if he's fined, that's going to change things also. In terms of how it's impacting the government's thinking, it all plays right into, there's a kind of febrile atmosphere. There's a really intensifying of the short-term focus of the things. Reforms take years to implement. Actually, that's no good for them. They're looking for things that are going to pay back now. So that's more populist policies like privatising Channel 4 or the Rwandan migrant proposal. They could also be looking for somewhere to shift the blame. So, you know, energy companies raising prices or, anyone with a consumer facing business. And how it's playing out in practice is this tension between number 10 and number 11. The way that might work in practice is, you know, number 11 have the power to block policy that number 10 really want to happen. And you see that happening when the prime minister wants something to be delivered by a department somewhere else in Whitehall, but number 11 and the Treasury have the power to stop that from happening because they don't want to give them money. So there's that way. And they're also looking for a much higher emphasis on value for money and return on investment on policies that the government is trying to implement. And there's inherent scepticism from number 11 that's not necessarily what they're getting from elsewhere. What we saw from the spring statement was, rather than trying to constantly intervene, this Treasury is trying to pick its moments. It is trying to take a slightly longer term focus on, you know, the people, capital and ideas that the Chancellor will be coming out with later in the year. So there's a longer term focus from the Treasury, but from number 10, it's about getting that backbench on side. You know, they've bought themselves a bit of time recently, but it's about keeping them on side and it's about voters. So that, I think that's the difference, the long term versus short term from number 10 and 11.
Thanks so much, Saima. As you say, tricky could be the word of the day. We've already had one possible contender when we were fighting with the technology before we went live. I'm going to come to Alice now, if I may. Alice Lilly from the Institute of Government. To focus first on the Queen's speech, the sort of legislative chunk of the conversation that we're going to have today. And I think broadly people knows what it is, but just tell us, what does the Queen's speech do? Why does it matter? Is it just a sort of performance?
The performance is definitely a part of it, and that kind of symbolic ceremonial aspect of bringing together, you know, the Commons, the Lords, and the monarch is really important, or the monarch's representative in this case. But in terms of the kind of legislative part of it, it's really about giving the government a kind of shop window to say, actually, this is what we're focusing on. These are the things, the sort of themes and issues that we're, you know, we really want to kind of foreground over the next year, setting out a sort of direction of travel. And I think giving a bit of a kind of nod to their own backbenchers, you know, this is what we're thinking about. We've been listening to what it is that you're interested in, and here's our agenda. Sort of start thinking now about what your position is on all of this. So in that sense, you know, it matters. What is quite interesting, of course, is that the government is never bound by what they say in the Queen's speech. They don't have to follow through on everything that they outlined yesterday. Equally, if they want to introduce further legislation down the road, there's nothing to stop them doing that. And what was really striking yesterday morning, you know, a couple of hours before the Queen's speech, if you opened the newspapers yesterday morning, you were seeing speculation about a potential emergency budget and finance bill, and about legislation potentially to change the Northern Ireland Protocol.
It rather reminds me of a career limiting move on my part, but it rather reminds me of the strategy presentations I used to do when I was a chief marketing officer. I did a brilliant presentation in the boardroom. I think, well, if I deliver half of that, I'll have done quite well. And one of the striking things about yesterday was there was so much in it, but we haven't finished the last one. There's a whole ton of stuff that was announced in the last Queen's speech that still hasn't quite made it through the process. Obviously, there is a process that, you know, the Commons do it and then the Lords do it. So tell us a bit, let's try and draw together. There's the legislative sort of shopping list, if you like, that we heard about.
Yeah.
And then this political context, and they're not indistinct from one another in terms of the decision-making of what goes in and what gets left behind.
Yeah, absolutely. So government set out 38 bills yesterday. Now, of those 38, four are things that have been carried over from the last session of Parliament. So some of those were things that were introduced quite late on in the session, like the online safety bill was actually only introduced a couple of months ago. They just kind of ran out of time and have carried it over. It's quite normal for governments to do that. There's usually a small handful of bills in each session. But what it means is, of course, they've still got the bulk of the work to do on those pieces of legislation. It's also worth saying that a further five of those 38 bills are things that the government has said that they will introduce just as draft pieces of legislation. So they won't actually be aiming to get those through in the next session of Parliament. It's just about giving MPs and Lords, you know, the chance to kind of scrutinise them. But nonetheless, it's still a pretty big workload for the government, and an unusually high workload as well.
I'm going to bring in Greg here. Greg Rosen is with us, senior counsel at SEC Newgate, a strategic communications advisory firm. Nice to see you, Greg. Thanks for being here. On this point that Alice is making about the volume of work, the sort of length of the shopping list that the government announced yesterday, that you've got to ask how serious they are about actually getting through this, given there's still quite a bit left over from last time they haven't quite finished. And therefore, if they're not fully hell-bent on implementing any of this stuff, or all of this stuff, I should say, what's the point?
Exactly that. And what we're seeing in the Queen's Speech shopping list reflects that, is the government, which is clear on some of the greatest challenges that Britain faces and it faces, but doesn't yet have a strategy for addressing them. Talking to a senior Conservative MP the other day, they were fully candid in saying that the single biggest challenge facing their constituents and their entree was the cost of living. But the government doesn't yet have clear answers to those. I asked that MP what the problem was from their perspective with windfall tax. They said they weren't sure. They weren't sure why the government wasn't implementing it. The government's clearly painted themselves into a corner on that, and Labour's getting a lot of cut through. So the government hasn't got a strategy clearly to address the short-term cost of living challenges. We know from the coverage of the Energy Security Strategy publication the other day that there was a lot of good ideas in the initial draft that went through for the right round around government that was then stripped out in that battle that Alice, you've just been talking about, between Treasury and bits of number 10 and different ministers and departments saying we object to this, we object to that. So you've got a lowest common denominator problem there. But the government does have a strategy, a common strategy for winning the next election. And the range of bills it's got enables it to create a debate on a whole range of issues, even if nothing necessarily comes out the other side in terms of concrete action. And what we might find is some bills ending up in big rows in the Lords and not getting anywhere. But that in itself creates a debate in the media that the government is will be keen to play into an election.
It creates a really legitimate sort of platform for the Conservative Party to articulate a position on a lot of things, even if they're not then going to have to sort of stand by it in terms of implementing laws. It's really fascinating. Greg, I just want to lean in again to this point about cost of living, particularly as it relates to energy. You're particularly interested in energy policy and energy security. You've mentioned it just now. Does the energy bill itself go far enough is one part of my question. And the other part is there really wasn't that much yesterday that spoke directly to the cost of living crisis. And if what the government is grappling with, to Simon's point at the beginning, is balancing real short-term challenges, real, like, you know, people, ordinary people, working people, I'm using all those annoying media news phrases that don't mean anything, are frightened about their realities of the money that they have coming through their households. That seems to me to be a problem for the government. If what they want to do is create a short-term compelling pitch, but they haven't addressed that really in this sort of smorgasbord of legislative and policy work, that's a gap, isn't it?
It's a huge gap. And the political consequence of that could be pretty major. I mean, if you look historically, the election that Boris should fear is a repeat of February 1974, the last time the cost of living was so significant for such a big chunk of voters in Britain was the 3-day week, the oil crisis in 1973-74. And when the Prime Minister then called in an election on who runs Britain, the result from the voters was not you. Yeah. And it wasn't at that point that Labour got a big landslide. It didn't. It scraped in with a majority of three in the February 1974 election. But the Conservatives had hoped in that election to dominate the narrative. It was on energy policy, of course, and it hadn't worked out because a lot of voters expected the government to take responsibility for sorting out some of these big problems. And if a government said, I can't do it, really, I need another vote from you, they said, well, maybe try someone else. But in terms of the specifics of the energy bill, what's fascinating is that there's a big chunky things in there, but they're mostly long-term or regulatory. In fairness, Kwasi Kwarteng and Greg Hands are showing themselves to be really effective ministers. some of the most impressive energy ministers that there have been at Bay Secretary of State for years. Kwasi Kwarteng's the first energy minister in 30 years to ask serious questions about why we can't build long-term storage in this country. These are the big questions that ministers should be asking, and he's doing a good job. But the bill is primarily about things like carbon capture and storage and nuclear, which will take years to come on. They may be good things, but they'll take years to come on, and certainly aren't going to have any impact on the short-term energy crisis we've got now.
I'm going to bring in Simon. Yes, go for it. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to make a couple of points on that, on the energy bill specifically. Agree with what you're saying about really, really great to see that ambition and having an energy bill that hasn't been one since 2013. So there's also a lot of stuff that needs to be kind of mopped up and tidied up. But having something that's actually going to implement on the energy security strategy and have deployment for new technology. I had a really good conversation with the ministers in Bays yesterday about their ambition. And I agree that, you know, there's good stuff. One thing that was missing from the Queen's speech was on planning. So we have these big infrastructure ambitions like offshore wind and new housing and things like that. But then they get stuck in planning, and planning takes a long time. So to your point, Greg, about things being longer term, they don't need to be as long term as they are. So actually, you know, Bays have said that they are working on some of the offshore wind planning stuff, but there's a lot more that can be done around that kind of thing that's not fiscally, doesn't rely on a fiscal moment. You know, they can take action on some of these things. So one of the points that Alice and Greg, you guys were making earlier on about that kind of long-term versus short-term view, and Alice, to your point about there's a lot of long-term stuff in the Queen's speech, I was actually really encouraged by the government's focus on, you know, the Prime Minister stood up and talked about growth. You know, we think that, you know, business is the engine of growth, and the engine of growth that is going to move us out of, you know, longer term economic turmoil. One of the things, though, is that there's action that government needs to take now. So it's all very well to have this ambition in the Queen's speech. And that's, you know, I've got my green camp, amber camp and red camp, which I'm very happy to talk through. There's some good stuff in there. There's stuff that we wanted more on. There's stuff that we think we need to be careful about. But what you need to do is, whilst you're waiting for the next fiscal moment and whilst you are waiting to implement this legislation in different parliamentary periods, there's stuff that needs action now. So, you know, sustainable aviation fuels and the Jet Zero consultation response might seem kind of specific, but it's something that the government could do that will unlock investment from business and will, you know, have stimulative effects on the economy by unlocking investment. And there's a few things like that that I think government should be seeing as a package, which would be really helpful for our members to feel like they can invest further.
Can I just come back very briefly on that? I think such an important point you've made about planning. And I should have said before that there are some things that the government can do in terms of short-term energy measures, many of which the energy ministers and Kwasi as Secretary of State have been keen to encourage, but many of them are non-legislative. Mm-hmm. So they have already got the powers to boost solar, to boost wind, and there's a pipeline there that can be deployable very quickly. But you also need to connect that up with grid. And there's been historic underinvestment in grid over the past decade at least, and reluctance by Ofgem and others to sanction future-proofing of grid. The grid was built primarily around old coal-fired power stations in Battersea and Bankside, rather than wind and solar dispersed around the country, wind in windy places, solar at sunny. And you need to put wires in different places and build new wires. And a lot of folk historically in Ofgem were saying, oh, you know, is net zero really going to be a proper thing, or is it going to be a passing fad? And the government, to its great credit, has been very, very solid on that. And the energy security strategy was very clear in giving a very clear instruction to Ofgem. We need the grid future-proofed, but it's taken till now to do it. And huge credit to the current team of ministers and the Prime Minister for pushing that. But we're making up for a lot of lost time. And the big thing that they could do that they're not doing yet is improving the planning system to make that quicker and easier. And that is something that could so unlock things, because it does take so long to do that.
Yeah, really fascinating. I want to talk a little bit more about the local election results, about what actually happened on Thursday and what it might mean. And maybe as a sort of backdrop to my question, is And Saima touched on it when you described the sort of philosophical, the conservative philosophical sort of antagonism between number 10 and number 11. And I think what we're seeing in some of the tension between Tory backbenchers and the front bench is more of a sort of social, perhaps, tension between what we stand for. And in all of, you know, this is a government with a thumping majority still in the Commons, has struggled to get legislative work through, perhaps, and policy work through, perhaps surprisingly, given how what you might anticipate with an 80-odd majority. We are the party of X for the Conservative Party. It's not super easy to know what X stands for at the moment. Alice, what do you think? How do voters, what do the local elections tell us, if anything, about how voters would fill in the blank about we are the party of X? What is this government for?
It's a really interesting question. And actually, I think a good way into it is just picking up on something Saima just mentioned, which is about planning reform. So it's been sort of long expected that the government would introduce a separate piece of legislation on planning reform, and then it wasn't there yesterday. And almost certainly the reason that it wasn't there yesterday was because the government realises that it is incredibly unpopular with a large section of its own MPs, and therefore it's had to sacrifice that. And actually that tells us something quite interesting about the Parliamentary Conservative Party, which is that, yes, the government has a big majority, but as you say, it's actually struggled. There's been an awful lot of rebellions among Tory MPs. We did a bit of analysis a couple of months ago, and we think that there's been kind of well over a third of all Tory MPs have rebelled at least once since the 2019 election. That's pretty remarkable. Mm-hmm. And you have this kind of difference between your sort of Southern English Conservative MPs and your Red Wall Conservative MPs. But on an issue like planning, they're likely to have quite different views about what's there. And so it's a really interesting example of actually how you have this kind of quite big, quite broad coalition of Conservative voters and of Conservative MPs. But actually, that can end up being a bit of a headache for the government, because how do you kind of keep both sides of your party? How do you keep both sides of your own MPs happy? And I think that's one of the big things that the government will struggle with. And that again comes back to this point of, not only have they unveiled this big laundry list of things that they want to do, and that's going to take up an awful lot of time, it's also going to be quite difficult for them in terms of kind of parliamentary handling. And some of the stuff they set out yesterday, we know that there's a lot of disagreement within the Conservative Party on that. So we are beginning to see sort of some of those differences between those wings of the party emerge.
Interesting. Simon, what did you make of what happened in the local election results? What does it mean, well, I suppose for business particularly, since that's your frame?
I think that, I don't think anybody was celebrating necessarily that night. I think expectations were very well managed on both sides politically. I'm talking about the two main parties, obviously.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think the Lib Dems were pretty thrilled.
I think there was probably some celebration in the Lib Dem camp. But in terms of Labour and Conservative, I think Margaret Thatcher's favourite constituency was lost. I think that, you know, those kind of symbolic losses in Wandsworth and Barnet and a few other places have made the Conservatives stand up and think a little bit. But the Red Wall stayed blue. You know, they strengthened their hold in Nuneaton and Hartlepool. Labour wins weren't as big as they thought that they might be. I think what it does is it keeps the... I think if you were going to have grumpy lot councillors who lost their seats out in the news talking about Partygate and Beergate and cost of living, we'd have had more of that than we've had. So I think people are at bay for now, which is why I think no one's particularly celebrating. I think what's quite interesting, though, is Northern Ireland and Scotland. And I think where people have had to look at Scotland the way they've looked at Scotland in the past, they're now going to have to look at Northern Ireland potentially in that way, with Sinn Féin and their win. So that's potentially quite significant. But again, I think it plays into the short-term focus of number 10. So, you know, Alice was saying that planning, could keep talking about planning. It's a really good example of how, you know, you've had to give things to backbenchers, give things on local issues. And that's worked for now, but there will be something else that means that is not going to work. You know, there are going to be other things that need to be, concessions that need to be made, agreements that need to be agreed. So I think the for now point is quite important. It's okay for now, but it could have an impact on how they make policy and decisions in the not very far away future.
Interesting. Greg, what do you think?
Completely agree with what's been said. A couple of points I'd add. I think there are some extra celebrations in some quarters, in addition to the totemic win for Labour in Westminster, and that's a big thing. But some Conservatives will say that is being expected in a broad sweep of losing support in sort of Remain voting South East England. Scotland and Wales were very significantly positive results for Labour. In both Scotland and Wales, in contrast to the Red Wall, Labour really, really went up. In Scotland, with the leadership, Fianna Sauer, recovering second place and winning a good chunk of seats back. They've got proportional representation in Scotland local elections, so the actual seat gains are less than you get with the big swings. But the Conservatives really lost support in Scotland. Yeah. And so Labour will be really pleased with that result. The Conservatives really worried. And that will matter in terms of the politics of Scotland going forward and the politics of the UK next general election. In Wales, and the Conservatives made some important gains there in Parliament, the last election and before. And Labour have been worried about their support. Labour, again, really making very substantial gains there, in many ways, more than in Scotland. But so they'll be really pleased with both. For the Lib Dems, they're obviously very pleased about gains in South East England. But Somerset was huge. Unitary authority there. And the Lib Dems, the last election, clearly struggled outside the South East. Yes. Winning St Albans, they're doing very well in Esher, some of those commuter land seats in South East England with high Remain votes. But historically, when the Lib Dems were at 50-60 seats back in 2010-2005, those were seats in the South West, which often voted Brexit. And there's been a big question about could the Lib Dems regain their support there. And Somerset, new unitary council, the Conservatives had massive, massive losses there. And the Lib Dems will be very, very pleased. And I think the Conservatives are quite worried. The other thing, though, is historically, if you look at 1990-91, Conservatives did badly in local elections. Labour did very well. The Conservatives still won the general election. It's not an absolute guide.
Yeah. If only it were. Alice, anything to add on local elections from your perspective? No.
Covered beautifully.
This is a brilliant question, I think, from Jack Semple, who's joined us today. Is the term net zero now dropped from the government's lexicon? I might lob that to Greg to begin with. I think probably what Jack is sort of slightly leaning into is net zero has almost sort of become, it sits at the fulcrum between that long-term economic and ideological sort of horizon that we've been talking about, and the sort of short-term, almost culture war-y kind of phrase, which is, causes those tensions. I can see Simon nodding. Maybe you want to go first. I mean, it's a horrible prospect, but do you have a sense that net zero is talked about less, or is it just a question of whether the term itself has become a bit of a lightning rod for something?
Yeah, I think what's really interesting is that second point you were making about the lightning rod. You know, you have a set of MPs who, for whom Brexit was the big thing,
yeah,
whom now net zero and green is becoming a big thing. I actually think, and come to the CBI decarbonisation conference next month, because thanks very much, because we will be talking a lot about this stuff. I think, you know, we've been talking about the government's energy bill that's incoming. It's going to be their flagship bill in, I think, the third quarter of Parliament. Mm. And in that, there's a lot of stuff, you know, Greg was talking about grid. There's a lot of stuff on grid and operators and things like that, which is essential to delivering technology that we need for net zero. So for me, that's part of how the government is putting their money where their mouth is on delivering on net zero, on energy security and the Prime Minister's 10-point plan. I'm encouraged by that. Yeah. I'm not sold on it yet, because as Alice was saying earlier on, when bills come into the House, things chop and change. Things that we need might chop and change based on politics. Mm. And that set of the Conservative Party that see net zero as, you know, a financial burden or a fiscal yeah. burden rather than an opportunity, which is what it is. You know, if you look at the plain numbers of the fact, regardless of the fact that we need to do the right thing for our planet, morally, on the numbers game, it is a good thing to do. The only thing, other thing I would add, though, is business need money in order to be able to invest. If we are to invest in new technologies for low carbon in the energy sector, or for new ways to produce food, or things that impact on net zero and on our targets, business need to have money in order to be able to invest. So government needs to take seriously the growth ambition that it is talking about in order to allow business to make those investments.
Interesting. Greg, what do you think?
I'd nuance it slightly. I don't think the government's ambition for net zero is in any way undimmed. And I would argue that the focus on energy security is very much an and rather than an or. If you look at the main announcements that the Prime Minister has made over his term as Prime Minister, his speeches to Conservative Party conference, most of them have actually been on green energy. Huge offshore wind targets, 2035, completely clean energy. There is a massive, massive commitment at the heart of government to what is net zero. Mm. And much of that comes from Brexiteers. So, yes, there is a group of Brexiteers who are very much against net zero, who don't see global warming and the challenge of it in the same way that many others do. But they are absolutely not dominating this government. And there are many other Brexiteers who are equally as committed to Brexit, like Zach Goldsmith, who are strongly of a different view. And yeah. I think that's important. And actually, where the government had challenges with the energy security strategy in terms of commitments to boost clean energy, it wasn't so much the problem of the opposition of the anti-green campaigners. It was NIMBY problems. Mm. So the problems with solar and wind and building grid and everything isn't because Steve Baker says that, you know, we should be cautious about net zero. It's because others within government are concerned about NIMBY reaction, negative NIMBY reaction from Conservative activists.
Mm. Yeah, really interesting. We've got two great questions coming that I'd love to have time for, at least briefly, if we can. This from David Lonsdale on Northern Ireland. Alice, do you want to have a crack at this? Do you see the Northern Ireland Executive being reformed in the months ahead? It's been dogged by all sorts of issues in terms of functioning properly as anything, really. Or are we heading for a Stormont election in 6 months? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of million-dollar question. I think we should probably have a much clearer sense in the next few days. We're, you know, still waiting to hear very much what the DUP response is. The sort of expectation is that they are unlikely to want to go into an executive with Sinn Féin, as you might imagine. But I think we're waiting to have that definitively confirmed. And I suppose the other thing that adds an extra layer of complexity to all of this is not just what's happening at Stormont, but what's happening in Westminster. And we've still got an awful lot of uncertainty about whether the government is going to legislate to try and change aspects of the protocol that was negotiated. You know, we're hearing that legislation could be introduced as soon as Tuesday of next week. Well, actually, there's a kind of negotiation and a trade-off that's happening there, which is between what the UK government wants to do on the protocol, what the DUP wants on the protocol, and therefore perhaps that might influence the DUP's decision on what they do in Stormont and whether the executive can form or whether we are going to end up with elections. So I think it will become a lot clearer in the next few days. But it's definitely a really rocky period ahead politically. And of course, that's something that just causes immense uncertainty for the businesses who are operating in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much, Alice. I'm going to put this one to Simon, if I may. Question from Tom Hadley. As Brexit-related realities continue to play out, how might the CBI's public position on the impact, I think he means on Brexit, on the economy and the labour market, et cetera, evolve? Obviously, CBI is a close partner to the government. As the sort of realities of the implications of it, and I know we've sort of had, is it Brexit, is it COVID, is it a bit of both? All of that's been difficult to sort of see what is really Brexit related and what isn't. Do you see, do you have a sense of your own evaluation of the situation now?
Yeah, I think the last thing that business needs in the face of the headwinds that we have is more headwinds. Mm. I think both sides, I would urge both sides to work to resolve this. You know, Brexit was done and there are opportunities. Someone else has asked a question about crypto and, you know, there's opportunities for future regulation that the UK could take the lead in some of these emerging technologies, for example, because we can regulate differently. Mm. There are prizes. We want to look forward. There's also the cost of living crisis is really important. And that is what is taking up time in Belfast, in Dublin, in London, in Brussels. And, you know, we want a resolution on this. We don't need more headwinds.
Yeah. And Simon, on the question about crypto from Ricardo, I think Ricardo it's a long question. He's sort of saying, does it go far enough, basically? Could you sort of ventriloquize a little bit where the government is at with crypto in general? Because it is still, I know it's an emerging thing, I know there's lots of people making money out of it, but it is still controversial as a concept. Some of the conversations we've had inside our newsroom about crypto as really sort of a glorified global pyramid scheme, you know, there are people who have strong views about this stuff. Has the government fully bought in, or is it still kind of hedging its bets on crypto?
So I would, not being a crypto expert, I think it's more about where the government can regulate. So, you know, I think also that what Ricardo was talking about was the kind of general ambition for government for a digital economy. And we've been having some quite encouraging conversations with the government on our work with them on the digital economy. So that we have a tech council at the CBI, and we're working with the government on streamlining digital regulation. And, you know, as part of that is what are the post-Brexit regulatory opportunities in the digital space? I was a bit disappointed to see that Ofcom weren't given more powers to help to regulate. I think on the digital legislation that was in the Queen's speech, it's good to see ambition. We need to make sure that we match that with engagement with business, because there is a risk that if you regulate incorrectly, you stifle innovation. Yeah. But I think, you know, the CBI has a good working relationship with government on this stuff. So if you're a member, come and have a chat if you want to get involved in some of the work that we're doing in this. But I think there are opportunities and we're working with the government on what those are.
Great. There's lots to come back to, I think, on that and on probably the next phase of Net Zero too. Just while we get into our last minute or so, I'm going to come back to Greg. Your bread and butter is strategic advisory. So what are the sort of, I mean, I'm going to say top three, but you can pick a number. It can be one, it can be five briefly. From what we've learned from the past 10 days, the speech, the local elections, the whole thing, what are you telling your clients to think about when it comes to planning? Perhaps let's give ourselves a 12-month horizon. What are the things that we've learned that are new?
I think that this underlines that the optics of policy making and the politics of policy making are far more important for this government than many previous governments. Mm. And to engage successfully in the policy making process, businesses need to have regard for that. There was a time a few years ago when businesses, particularly larger businesses, would have regular contact with particular officials in a particular department, and they'd be able to have measured discussions as regulation evolved. And it was really about going through the detail with them, and it wouldn't necessarily get muddied by politics. And now everything is muddied by politics, and things can really flare up. I mean, we see that with Beergate and Partygate and all of these things. I mean, Harold Wilson talked about a week being a long time in politics, and now it's ever shorter. Mm-hmm. And there was been a hope, I think, for all of us involved, that the instability, if we call it that, that came after the Brexit referendum would at some point calm down. And it doesn't seem to have yet. And there isn't sign of that yet. The Labour Party is electable in a way that it wasn't before, but there's still a way to go. There is an election in the offing, and it is very clear that this government is moving itself towards an election footing. So any business needs to be mindful of the possibility that this government will be here for the long term. There could be a new Conservative leader shortly, or you could get a Labour-led government potentially with a different leader than we have now as well. And all that requires measured engagement at the political level as well as with Whitehall.
My goodness, here we go again. Thank you very much to Alice Lilly from the Institute for Government, to Greg Rosen from SEC Newgate, and of course to Simon Coletti-Aldridge from the CBI. It's been a fascinating conversation, and lots of threads that I hope that we will come back to. Thank you very much. If you're watching live, if you're listening back, as I always say, whatever you're doing next, go put the kettle on before you look at your emails. Have a great rest of the day. Thanks. Bye-bye.